From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Warner Brothers has a new studio chief, and she arrives as Hollywood tries to figure out its future. Then the movie Yesterday imagines that all the music by the Beatles were forgotten, except for one struggling musician. Himesh Patel plays that singer who had to reinvent the songs.
The songs are just so amazing that you can never separate them from those four. And in a way, that's what we're saying with our film, is that even if they don't exist, you can't recreate them to be anything better.
And we meet one Armenian-American keeping her culture's musical history alive. All that coming up on The Frame. There's a new studio chief in town. Warner Media has announced Ann Sarnoff as its new CEO. She's the first woman to lead Warner Brothers and one of the only women who has ever led a major Hollywood studio. Although she's not well known to many in Hollywood, Sarnoff has held various senior positions in media and in sports. She comes to Warner Brothers from BBC America, and she's taking over at a time of significant, if not unprecedented, change. To talk it over, I called up Eric Schwartzel. He covers the film industry for The Wall Street Journal.
Well, this has been an open job for several months now since Kevin Tsujihara, the former head of the studio, stepped down in a personal scandal that involved, it appeared he was helping certain actresses with whom he was sleeping with get roles or get auditions for roles within the studio. It's been several months now, and there have been, you know, the usual rumor mill of names popping up about who might get this top job. I have to say, no one had Ann Sarnoff on the list, as far as I could tell. You know, she's certainly coming in from the outside and taking the job.
So let's talk a little bit about her background and a little bit about the history of people who have come not from studio leadership positions to run studios. I mean, off the top of my head, I can think of some people who came in to run studios that didn't have a lot of studio experience, that didn't do really well. I'm thinking of Rich Ross at Disney, Gail Berman at Paramount. Why is Ann Sarnoff in some ways qualified for this job, and what are the challenges that she's going to face?
Well, I think the challenges she's going to face are the ones facing any studio executive right now. One is certainly, how do you navigate a world where you have to oversee theatrical, film, television, and streaming operations? How do you referee those divisions internally? And how do you decide what your strategy is and where to put your resources? Do you go in on streaming, or do you try and, you know, still make that money at the box office that some big movie still can? The other challenge she has is that she's at a studio that isn't Disney right now. And it seems like right now we are in this dynamic in Hollywood where everyone is either Disney or not Disney. And you have to constantly pivot in response to what they're doing, because their dominance, especially at the theatrical box office, I should say, is so high right now. And I think you're right. It's interesting. When we were doing the story yesterday, I looked and I realized the last time one of these top jobs was open, which was at Paramount in 2017, they went with Jim Giannopoulos, who had just been fired from Fox and been replaced by Stacy Snyder, who had previously run Universal. So for whatever reason, Hollywood does certainly like to hire within. So that makes this hire a little different, and also might be a reflection of Warner Brothers' new owners, which is AT&T. They might not be as beholden to that idea that you have to get someone who's done this before.
And it also feels like, given how much change has been happening in Hollywood just over the last couple of years, that somebody like Ann Sarnoff, who has worked at the BBC, she's worked at Nickelodeon, she worked in the women's NBA, it feels like that kind of resume is actually maybe really attractive now, that if you have experience in different areas of the business, and even something as unusual as women's basketball, that might actually be an asset as opposed to a liability compared to somebody who's only worked in the movie business.
That's a great point. I mean, it's the same kind of issues, right? Like, fighting for attention in an attention deficit economy, and building a brand, and following consumers home, and you know, all this talk of direct to consumer has been focused certainly on streaming, but, you know, thinking about how do you exactly resonate with everyday consumers is probably the number one issue facing studio chiefs right now. So I think you're right. I think that kind of diversity of experience can prove, you know, super helpful. Of course, it'll also be the first thing that's cited if things don't go well.
Ann Sarnoff is the first woman to head Warner Brothers, and other studios have been run by women. Amy Pascal at Sony, Stacy Snyder at Universal, then at Fox, Donna Langley at Universal. How important is it, just in terms of representation, that Warner Brothers has finally hired a woman to run the studio?
I think you're right. I think it's huge in terms of representation. I think internally at the company, it's very good, because I think, you know, there was some internal consternation over a lack of female leadership in the C-suite there. And I think the other thing that will be interesting to watch is, you've seen, as some executives have been run out of town for, you know, personal scandals or personal drama, how, like, having someone in that position affects the actual programming or the movies that are getting greenlit. Everyone brings a different sensibility to the job, and it's interesting, always interesting, to see what that diversity at the top then ends up affecting in theaters, you know, 2-3 years down the line.
Let's talk about streaming. Disney is going to launch its streaming services later this year. I think Warner Brothers is on track to do something next year. What are Warner's plans in streaming, and how much of an opportunity do they have there, and who are they going to be up against?
They're going to be up against a lot of people. They have a couple things certainly in their back pocket that will help, right? They've got HBO, and HBO has had certainly some success in streaming. They do have some of these franchises. They certainly have a library that would be pretty robust. But I think that they have an issue that Universal also has, which is that if you stop a bunch of people on the street and ask them what is a Warner Brothers movie or what does Warner Brothers produce, they're not going to be able to name much beyond DC Comics and maybe Harry Potter. There's not that kind of brand recognition that Disney has, where if you say Disney, you immediately know the kind of content you're going to be getting. So I think navigating that is going to be a little tricky. But you're right. It seems like Warner and Universal and a couple others, maybe CBS, are all kind of vying for that third spot that comes after Netflix and Disney. A lot of analysts you talk to think Netflix is just so far ahead that they're not going anywhere. Disney has that brand equity that's going to get a lot of people to sign up, and then that there might be room for a third, depending on what kind of consumer you are. And it seems like Warner and Universal are all trying to fit into that space.
Eric Schwartzel covers the film industry for the Wall Street Journal. Eric, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming back on the show.
You bet. Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, the new movie Yesterday imagines a world with no memory of Beatles music. We meet the actor who plays the one guy who didn't forget. What if, thanks to some bizarre worldwide blackout, the Beatles never existed and only one person remembered the band's music? That's the high concept idea behind the new film Yesterday. It's written by Richard Curtis and directed by Danny Boyle. The film stars Himesh Patel as Jack. He's a struggling singer-songwriter, but after the global power grid goes haywire, he alone knows all the songs by the Beatles.
I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday.
What the hell was that?
Yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
The Beatles.
The what?
John, Paul, George and Ringo, the Beatles.
Himesh Patel performs all the music in the film. It's also his first starring role in a major motion picture. Here's how he got the job.
My first contact was an email from my agent. I was actually in New York doing a play, and it was an email that just said there's a new Danny Boyle film with working title, musical elements. And I didn't get a script. I just had to do a monologue from a play that they'd given me, and I had to sing a Coldplay song of my choice and send that off on a tape. And I did, and then I got an email saying, you know, they want to meet, and here's a draft of the script. And that was when I first learned that Richard was involved as a screenwriter, and I read the story. And you know, it starts off fairly normally, you know, and then this crazy thing happens about 10 pages in and everything gets turned on its head. And that was the minute that I went, this is absolutely incredible.
I want to ask you about the song that you chose to perform for your audition by Coldplay. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
I want to live life, never be cruel. I want to live life.
So the song is called We Never Change, and I'm wondering why that was your choice.
you know, Coldplay, they're an amazing live band, and they do these huge shows, and their sound has kind of grown to this stadium filling thing. And I didn't want to try and replicate that just with me and an acoustic guitar. And I just remember that song as being one that really moved me when I first heard that first album of theirs. But it did take quite a few attempts to get a take that I was willing to send off.
So earlier this year, you were at the movie theater convention in Las Vegas. It's called CinemaCon. And as is often the case, people talk about upcoming movies and show footage, but you did something a little different. You came out on stage at the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace. It's where Celine Dion usually performs. And you came out with a guitar, and this is what you did.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, what was that moment like? I mean, there are a couple thousand theater owners in there trying to figure out what movies they're going to book, what films they should show over the next couple of months, and you're out there basically all alone on this massive stage with your guitar. What do you remember from that day?
Not much. It was an amazing experience. What was funny was that I remember I had to make a joke to ease myself into it. I kind of said I didn't expect to be playing Caesar's Palace when I first signed up for this job, but there we go. There's a little shake to my voice, which is completely from nerves, but it was an amazing experience, and I'm glad that people responded so well.
I think what people probably should understand is these are not technically covers of Beatles songs. I mean, they are, but they aren't. How would you describe the way that your character Jack approaches these songs? Because again, the conceit is nobody knows them, but it's not as if he's trying to replicate what the Beatles sounded like, is it?
Not only do people not know them, they don't exist. So he has absolutely no reference point for where to even begin. It's all from his mind. So, of course, there, you know, perhaps in reality one would veer off even further with the lyrics, but you know, we really need to play tribute to these songs, so we don't want to veer too far from them. But at the same time, it meant that we had a freedom to really create our own versions of them, just to see what would happen if we did, what other magic lies within these songs if you just twist this bit here and there.
Something in the way she moves.
And that was the real joy of working with Daniel Pemberton, who was our composer, and his friend Ardem Ilhan, who came in, and we worked together for 2 months basically in this room that we converted in the offices in London to make it look like Jack's bedroom. We put posters up on the wall and a piano and a Wurlitzer and a record player, and I spent 2 months in that room with Ardem just learning the songs.
Somewhere in her smile she knows that I don't need no other lover. Something in her style that shows me.
We're talking with Himesh Patel about his film Yesterday. So at what point does the actor learning how to play the songs disappear and the character who is reimagining them start to take over?
As soon as the basics are there, as soon as, you know, I can play the song without really thinking about the playing of it. It's the same thing as what actors do. We learn the lines and learn the lines and learn the lines until we're not thinking about the lines. And so it's the same thing with learning the songs. You just keep playing the song and keep playing the song until your fingers don't think about where they need to go next. And so then you can start to draw in Richard's story.
And how important is it that you distance your own self from the recordings and reimagine them, that you have to forget, essentially, what it was that the Beatles did with the music and make it your own? Is it always something that you're hearing in the back of your head, or are you able to really divorce it and shut that out?
I think they'll always be there because, you know, you don't want to veer too far from it. And also, the songs are just so amazing that you can never separate them from those four. And in a way, that's what we're saying with our film, is that even if they don't exist, you can't recreate them to be anything better.
The other thing that you have to do as the character is you're playing alongside Ed Sheeran, and part of the idea of the film is that you're better than he is.
About the song, the title, Hey Jude, Jude is just It's a bit old-fashioned.
Let me just give you this advice, right? Song title. I won't charge you a penny for it as well. Hey, dude.
Hey, dude, are you sure?
He's right. That's so much better.
Is it?
Yeah. Hey, dude.
And that's got to be in itself kind of a meta moment where you are, as a performer, playing opposite Ed Sheeran, who obviously has a body of work and a lot of fans, and that you have to be the better of the two.
It's funny, really, because, you know, he's aware of his own standing, but not to the point of being grandiose about it in any way. You know, he turned up and rehearsed with us, you know, before we started production like anyone else would. He was ready to learn and collaborate, and Ed is such a normal guy that it didn't, at no point did I feel like, oh my gosh, it's Ed Sheeran. It was just Ed, just, you know, this actor who's come in to play Ed Sheeran. Looks a lot like Ed Sheeran. He's very good at being full of integrity and just a lad from Suffolk.
Part of the moral of the film is kind of the equivalent to absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that fame can become very intoxicating and kind of make you lose your bearings. And there's a scene toward the end of the film, without giving anything away, where Jack is playing on a rooftop to a lot of people. There's a big audience. And I'm wondering, as a performer, when that scene is happening, do you really start to understand what it must be like to be a rock star and to be playing in front of thousands of people? And what was that moment like for you?
Probably the closest I'm going to get to understanding that feeling, to be honest, because we literally did have thousands of people there on the beach and helicopters flying overhead, and it was really surreal. But what was strange was that narratively at that point, Jack isn't in the best place. And the song that he chooses to sing, which I won't ruin for people, but he sings it for a reason, and he screams it for a reason. So he was in a real place, and I had to really be there rather than be where, you know, Himesh wanted to be, which was, oh my gosh, I'm on a rooftop of a hotel playing to thousands of people on a beach. This is amazing.
I'm going to end with a quick quiz. You have been living, thinking, singing Beatles for probably longer than you care to remember right now. I have a couple of songs queued up. You're only going to hear 2 seconds of a couple of Beatles songs.
No.
I bet you're going to do better than most people would do. If you're ready, let's try it.
It's Hard Day's Night. It's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. All You Need Is Love.
Very good. 3 for 3.
In My Life.
And the last.
Yeah, I do know that. I feel like I'm having to sing it in my head. Ticket to Ride.
5 for 5. Himesh is batting 1,000. Himesh, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Hey,
Jude. Yesterday is out in theaters on Friday, June 28th. Coming up on The Frame, an Armenian-American pianist weaves her cultural history into her music.
Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better.
There are more Armenian-Americans in California than any other state in the country. And Los Angeles and Glendale have the highest number of Armenians in the entire state. There's an Armenian-American pianist and vocalist who is keeping her culture's legacy alive by integrating it into her music, and The Frame contributor Beto Arcos has her story.
Arani Agbabian sits in front of the Mason and Hamlin piano she inherited from her aunt, Lucina Agbabian, who was also her music teacher and mentor. Arani says her aunt taught her everything she knows about music.
All the fundamentals that I have in musicianship and musicality and performance, vocal technique. I studied with other teachers too after her, but she gave me my foundation.
Patience is more important.
Agbabian lives in an area called Sherwood Forest in the San Fernando Valley. Patience. When we spoke on a recent afternoon, she recalled her aunt's advice at a time when she was at a crossroads, considering a career as an academic.
She told me actually, a few weeks before she died, she said, you know, you can learn and you can learn and you can learn, but then what? go and sing. She said, go into the world and sing. Forget about being an academic.
Agbabian took her aunt's advice, and much of what she learned from her is present in the new album titled Bloom. She composed most of the pieces on her aunt's piano.
I have played on this piano since I was a kid, coming to her house for voice and music lessons. We would have children's music classes at her house, and this piano was there all the time. And then when she passed away, I inherited it.
Every Sunday morning for the past 3 years, Agbabian has sung at a ritual called the Offices of the Armenian Church. It takes place weekly at St. Peter Armenian Apostolic Church in Van Nuys. Agbabian says she wants to learn as much as possible about this ritual before the last torchbearers pass on.
The monastic tradition in the Armenian Church died, sadly, due to basically the genocide in 1915. All of the monasteries were destroyed, and so there isn't really a monastic life left in the Armenian Church like there is in the Coptic or Greek, churches. So there's just a few people singing these songs, these hymns.
On Easter Sunday, she and a group of singers performed a series of Armenian hymns called Sharagan, written by various composers throughout the early and medieval church history.
The master, he's about 88 years old, and they're from Istanbul. So it's from the Constantinopolitan tradition of Armenian chant. And I discovered him after having gone to Paris to study with a master singer who was also from Istanbul. So within that lineage, I was searching for other singers, and I heard that this church in the valley in Van Nuys has people from that who sing from that tradition.
At her home studio, Agbabian offers to play a song from the new album. The song is called Mother. Agbabian wrote it when she was still living at her aunt's house after she had passed away. The inspiration behind the song came during a Sunday liturgy.
Chanting in the church, I had an experience on the day of, they call it Chaorhornek. It's the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, and we were chanting, and all of a sudden I had this really, I can't explain, experience where I felt changed during the chanting, and this is related to that experience. Cleansed in
the Mother. The album also has a recurrent melody linked to the title, Bloom. This is called Petal One. Agbabian has a special gift for melody. She says the more rhythmic elements in the album come from her collaboration with percussionist Nicolas Stocker.
I wanted to use the piano also as purely a percussive sounding instrument. So I incorporated different ways of piano preparations to create different sounds that I wanted.
Agbabian's album is a diverse collection of melodic songs, rhythmic music, and a couple of traditional Armenian songs, including one called Anganim Arachi Ko. This was one of the first sacred hymns her aunt taught her. She liked it so much, she wrote a new arrangement and called it Anganim Revisited. Agbabian says traditional Armenian music was more present in her work 5 years ago.
At this point, I feel more inclined to writing my own music and then singing Armenian traditional music on its own, in its original forms.
In addition to her aunt, Agbabian also honors her mother, Alits Agbabian, a professional storyteller. One of the stories she heard from her is an Armenian legend called The Water Bride.
Once there was a young bride kneading dough to bake thin bread in her.
I just really liked this short legend because of the different ideas in it, like grace and forgiveness and transformation. Those are things that I've experienced a lot in my life, and really grateful that I can continue to live my life and just try to always become a better and better person.
Before I left her home, Arani Agbabian said her aunt Lucy would be really proud of her. she would be happy that she finished this album and that it was out in the world. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
And that's it for today from the Moen Broadcast Center. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. The Frame is back here tomorrow.